Blanco's two thug pals were back now and were beating off the plebe brats. Although he was groggy, his eyes were open and they were fixed on Toby. He'd felt that kick. Worse, he'd been humiliated by her in public. He'd lost face. Any minute now he'd haul himself up and pulverize her. "Bitch," he croaked, "I'll slice off your tits." Then Toby was surrounded by a crowd of children. Two of them took hold of her hands and the others formed themselves into an honor guard, front and back. "Hurry, hurry," they were saying as they pulled and pushed her along the street. There was a roar from behind.
"Get back here, bitch."
"Quick, this way," said the tallest boy. With Adam One covering the rear, they jogged through the streets of the sewage lagoon. It was like a parade. People stared. In addition to her panic, Toby felt unreal and a little dizzy. Now the crowds were becoming thinner and the smells less pungent. Fewer shops were boarded up.
"Faster," said Adam One. They ran up an alleyway and turned several corners in quick succession, and the shouting faded away.
They came to an early modern red brick factory building. On the front was a sign saying Pachinko over a smaller one that read, "Stardust Personal Massage, Second Floor, All Tastes Indulged, Nose Jobs Extra." The children ran around to the side of the building and began climbing up the fire escape, and Toby followed. She was out of breath, but they scampered up like monkeys. Once they reached the rooftop, each of them said,
"Welcome to our garden," and hugged her. And she was enveloped in the sweet, salty odor of unwashed children.
Toby couldn't remember being hugged by a child. For the children, it must have been a formality, like hugging a distant aunt. But for her, it was something she couldn't define. Fuzzy, softly intimate, like being nuzzled by rabbits, but rabbits from Mars. Nevertheless, she found it touching. She'd been touched in an impersonal but kindly way that was not sexual. Considering how she'd been living lately, with Blanco's the only hands touching her, the strangeness must have come, in part, from that. There were adults, too, holding out their hands in greeting. The women in dark, baggy dresses, the men in coveralls. And here, suddenly, was Rebecca.
"You made it, sweetheart," she said.
"I told them. I just knew they'd get you out."
The garden wasn't at all what Toby had expected from hearsay. It wasn't a baked mud flat strewn with rotting vegetable waste. Quite the reverse. She gazed around it in wonder. It was so beautiful, with plants and flowers of many kinds she'd never seen before. There were vivid butterflies. From nearby came the vibration of bees. Each petal and leaf was fully alive, shining with awareness of her. Even the air of the garden was different. She found herself crying with relief and gratitude. It was as if a large benevolent hand had reached down and picked her up and was holding her safe. Later, she frequently heard Adam One speak of being flooded with the light of God's creation, and without knowing it yet, that was how she felt.
"I'm so glad you have made this decision, my dear," said Adam One. But Toby didn't think she'd made any decision at all. Something else had made it for her. Despite everything that happened afterwards, this was a moment she never forgot.
That first evening, there was a modest celebration in honor of Toby's advent. A great fuss was made over the opening of a jar of preserved purple items. Those were her first elderberries, and a pot of honey was produced as if it was the Holy Grail. Adam One made a little speech about providential rescues. The brand plucked from the burning was mentioned, and the one lost sheep, she'd heard of those before, at church, but other unfamiliar examples of rescue were used as well. The relocated snail, the windfall pear. Then they'd eaten a sort of lentil pancake and a dish called Pilar's pickled mushroom medley, followed by slices of soy bread topped with the purple berries and the honey. After her initial elation, Toby was feeling stunned and uneasy. How had she got up here to this unlikely and somehow disturbing location?
What was she doing among these friendly, though bizarre, people with their wacky religion and right now their purple teeth?
Chapter 10. Toby's first weeks with the gardeners were not reassuring. Adam 1 gave her no instructions, he simply watched her, by which she understood that she was on probation. She tried to fit in to help when needed, but at the routine tasks she was inept. She couldn't sew tiny stitches the way Eve 9, Nuala, wanted, and after she'd bled into a few salads, Rebecca told her to lay off the vegetable chopping.
If I want it to look like beets, I'll put in beets, was what she said.
Bert, Adam 13, in charge of garden vegetables, discouraged her from weeding after she'd uprooted some of the artichokes by mistake. She could clean out the violet biolets, though. It was a simple chore that took no special training, so that is what she did. Adam 1 was well aware of her efforts.
The violets aren't so bad, are they? He said to her one day. After all, we're strict vegetarians here.
Toby wondered what he meant, but then she realized, less smelly, cow rather than dog. Figuring out the gardener hierarchy took her some time. Adam 1 insisted that all gardeners were equal on the spiritual level, but the same did not hold true for the material one. The Adams and the Eves ranked higher, though their numbers indicated their areas of expertise rather than their order of importance. In many ways, it was like a monastery, she thought. The inner chapter, then the lay brothers. And the lay sisters, of course. Except that chastity was not expected. Since she was accepting gardener hospitality and under false pretenses at that, she wasn't really a convert. She felt she should pay by working very hard. To the violet-biolet cleaning, she added other tasks. She carted fresh soil up to the rooftop via the fire escape. The gardeners had a supply of it gathered from deserted building sites and vacant lots to be mixed with compost and with violet-biolet byproducts. She melted down soap ends and decanted and labeled vinegar. She packaged worms for the Tree of Life Natural Materials Exchange. She mopped the floor of the Run for Your Light treadmills gym. She swept out the dormitory cubicles on the level below the rooftop, where the single members of the group slept every night on futons stuffed with dried plant materials. After several months of this, Adam 1 suggested that she put her other talents to work.
What other talents? Said Toby.
Didn't you study holistic healing? He asked, at Martha Graham.
Yes, Toby said. There was no point in asking how Adam 1 knew that about her, he just knew things. So she set to work making herbal lotions and creams. There wasn't much chopping involved, and she had a strong arm with the mortar and pestle. Soon after that, Adam 1 asked her to share her skills with the children, so she added several daily classes to her routine. By now, she was used to the dark, sack-like garments the women wore.
You'll want to grow your hair, said Nuala. Get rid of that scalped look. We gardener women all wear our hair long.
When Toby asked why, she was given to understand that the aesthetic preference was God's. This kind of smiling, bossy sanctimoniousness was a little too pervasive for Toby, especially among the female members of the sect. From time to time, she thought of deserting. For one thing, she was swept with periodic but shameful cravings for animal protein.
You ever feel like eating a secret burger?
She asked Rebecca. Rebecca was from her former world. Such things could be discussed with her.
I must admit it, said Rebecca. I do have those thoughts. They put something in them. It has to be some addictive thing.
The food was pleasant enough. Rebecca did her best with the limited materials available. But it was repetitious. In addition to that, the prayers were tedious. The theology scrambled. Why be so picky about lifestyle details if you believed everyone would soon be wiped off the face of the planet? The gardeners were convinced of impending disaster. Through no solid evidence that Toby could see, maybe they were reading bird entrails. A massive die-off of the human race was impending due to overpopulation and wickedness, but the gardeners exempted themselves. They intended to float above the waterless flood, with the aid of the food they were stashing away in the hidden store places they called Ararats.
As for the flotation devices in which they would ride out this flood, they themselves would be their own arks, stored with their own collections of inner animals, or at least the names of those animals. Thus they would survive to replenish the earth, or something like that. Toby asked Rebecca whether she really believed the gardener total disaster talk, but Rebecca wouldn't be drawn.
"They are good people," was all she'd say. "What comes just comes, so what I say is, relax."
Then she'd give Toby a honey soy donut. Good people or not, Toby couldn't see herself sticking it out among these fugitives from reality for long. But she couldn't just walk away openly. That would be too blatantly ungrateful. After all, these people had saved her skin. So she pictured herself slipping down the fire escape, past the sleeping level and the pachinko joint and the massage parlor on the floors below, and running off under cover of darkness, then hitching a solar car ride to some other city farther north. Planes were out of the question, being far too expensive and intensely scrutinized by the Corpse Corps. Even if she'd had the money for it, she couldn't take the bullet train. They checked identities there, and she didn't have one. Not only that, but Blanco would still be on the lookout for her, down on the plebe streets, him and his two thug pals. No woman ever got away from him, was his boast. Sooner or later, he'd track her down and make her pay. That kick of hers would be very expensive. It would take a publicly advertised gang rape or her head on a pole to wipe the slate. Was it possible that he didn't know where she was? No. The plebe rat gangs must have picked up such knowledge, the way they picked up every rumor and sold it to him. She'd been avoiding the streets, but what was to stop Blanco from coming after her up the fire escape and onto the rooftop? Finally, she shared her fears with Adam One. He knew about Blanco and what he was likely to do. He'd seen him in action. "I don't want to put the gardeners in danger," was how Toby put it. "My dear," said Adam One, "you are safe with us, or moderately safe." Blanco was Sewage Lagoon plebe mob, he explained, and the gardeners were next door in the sinkhole. "Different plebes, different mobs," he said. "They don't trespass unless they're having a mob war. In any case, the Corpse Corps run the mobs, and according to our information, they've declared us off limits."
"Why would they bother to do that?" asked Toby.
"It would be bad for their image to eviscerate anything with God in its name," said Adam One. "The corporations wouldn't approve of it, considering the influence of the Petro-Baptists and the known fruits among them. They claim to respect the spirit and to favor religious toleration, as long as the religions don't take to blowing things up. They have an aversion to the destruction of private property."
"They can't possibly like us," said Toby.
"Of course not," said Adam One. "They view us as twisted fanatics who combine food extremism with bad fashion sense and a puritanical attitude toward shopping. But we own nothing they want, so we don't qualify as terrorists. Sleep easier, dear Toby. You're guarded by angels." Curious angels, thought Toby. Not all of them angels of light. But she did sleep easier on her mattress of rustling husks. The Feast of Adam and All Primates. Year 10. Of God's Methodology in Creating Man. Spoken by Adam One.
Dear fellow gardeners in the earth that is God's garden, how wonderful to see you all assembled here in our beautiful Eden Cliff rooftop garden. I have enjoyed viewing the excellent tree of creatures created by our children from the plastic objects they've gleaned. Such a fine illustration of evil materials being put to good uses. And I look forward to our coming meal of fellowship featuring the turnips we stored from last year's harvest in Rebecca's delicious turnip pie, not to mention the pickled mushroom medley, courtesy of Pilar, our Eve 6. We also celebrate the promotion of Toby to full teaching status. By her hard work and dedication, Toby has shown us that a person can overcome so many painful experiences and inner obstacles once they have seen the light of truth. We are very proud of you, Toby. On the feast of Adam and all primates, we affirm our primate ancestry, an affirmation that has brought down wrath upon us from those who arrogantly persist in evolutionary denial. But we affirm also the divine agency that has caused us to be created in the way that we were. And this has enraged those scientific fools who say in their hearts, "There is no God." These claim to prove the non-existence of God because they cannot put him in a test tube and weigh and measure him. But God is pure spirit. So how can anyone reason that the failure to measure the immeasurable proves its non-existence? God is indeed the no-thing, the no-thingness, that through which and by which all material things exist. For if there were not such a no-thingness, existence would be so crammed full of materiality that no one thing could be distinguished from another. The mere existence of separate material things is a proof of the no-thingness of God. Where were the scientific fools when God laid the foundations of the earth by interposing his own spirit between one blob of matter and another, thus giving rise to forms? Where were they when the morning stars sang together? But let us forgive them in our hearts, for it is not our task today to reprimand, but to contemplate our own earthly state in all humility. God could have made man out of pure word, but he did not use this method. He could also have formed him from the dust of the earth, which in a sense he did, for what else can be signified by dust, but atoms and molecules, the building blocks of all material entities. In addition to this, he created us through the long and complex process of natural and sexual selection, which is none other than his ingenious device for instilling humility in man. He made us a little lower than the angels, but in other ways, and science bears this out, we are closely related to our fellow primates, a fact that the haughty ones of this world do not find pleasant to their self-esteem. Our appetites, our desires, our more uncontrollable emotions, all are primate. Our fall from the original garden was a fall from the innocent acting out of such patterns and impulses to a conscious and shamed awareness of them. And from thence comes our sadness, our anxiety, our doubt, our rage against God. True, we, like the other animals, were blessed and ordered to increase and multiply and to replenish the earth. But by what humiliating and aggressive and painful means this replenishing frequently takes place. No wonder we are born to a sense of guilt and disgrace. Why did he not make us pure spirit, like himself? Why did he embed us in perishable matter, and a matter so unfortunately monkey-like? So goes the ancient cry. What commandment did we disobey? The commandment to live the animal life in all simplicity, without clothing, so to speak. But we craved the knowledge of good and evil, and we obtained that knowledge, and now we are reaping the whirlwind. In our efforts to rise above ourselves, we have indeed fallen far, and are falling farther still. For, like the creation, the fall, too, is ongoing. Ours is a fall into greed. Why do we think that everything on earth belongs to us, while in reality we belong to everything? We have betrayed the trust of the animals and defiled our sacred task of stewardship. God's commandment to replenish the earth did not mean we should fill it to overflowing with ourselves, thus wiping out everything else. How many other species have we already annihilated? Insofar as you do it unto the least of God's creatures, you do it unto him. Please consider that, my friends, the next time you crush a worm underfoot or disparage a beetle. We pray that we may not fall into the error of pride by considering ourselves as exceptional, alone in all creation in having souls, and that we will not vainly imagine that we are set above all other life and may destroy it at our pleasure and with impunity. We thank Thee, O God, for having made us in such a way as to remind us not only of our less than angelic being, but also of the knots of DNA and RNA that tie us to our many fellow creatures. Let us sing, O Let Me Not Be Proud.
Let me not be proud, dear Lord, nor rank myself above the other primates through whose genes we grew into your love. A million, million years, your days, your methods past discerning. Yet through your blend of DNAs came passion, mind, and learning. Let me not be proud, dear Lord. Let me not be proud. We cannot always trace your path through monkey and gorilla. Yet all are sheltered underneath your heavenly umbrella. And if we vaunt and puff ourselves with vanity and pride, recall Australopithecus, our animal inside. Let me not be proud, dear Lord. Let me not be proud. Let me not be proud, dear Lord. Let me not be proud. So keep us far from worser traits, aggression, anger, greed. Let us not scorn our lowly birth, nor yet our primate seed. Let me not be proud, dear Lord. Let me not be proud. Oh, let me not be proud, dear Lord. Let me not be proud, dear
Chapter 11. Wren. Year 25. When I'm thinking back over that night, the night the waterless flood first began, I can't recall anything out of the ordinary. Around 7 o'clock I was feeling hungry, so I got a Jolt bar from the mini-fridge and ate half of it. I only ever ate half of anything, because a girl with my body type can't afford to blimp up. I once asked Mortis if I should get bimplants, but he said I could play underage in a dim light, and there was heavy demand for the schoolgirl act. I ran through some chin-ups and did my Kegel floor exercises, and then Mortis called in on my video phone to see if I was okay. He missed me, because no one could work the crowd like me. "Ren, you make them shit $1,000 bills," he said, and I blew him a kiss. "Keeping your butt in shape," he said, so I held the video phone behind me. "Chicken licking good," he said. Even if you were feeling ugly, he made you feel pretty. After that, I hit the snake pit video to check the action and dance along to the music. It was strange to watch everything going on without me, as if I'd been erased. Crimson Petal was teasing the pole. Savona was subbing for me on the trapeze. She looked good, glittery and green and sinuous, with a new silver mohair. I was considering one of those myself. They were better than wigs. They never came off. But some girls said the smell was like lamb chops, especially in the rain. Savona was a little clumsy. She wasn't a trapeze girl. She was a pole girl. And she was top-heavy. She'd blown herself up like a beach ball. Stick her on stilettos, breathe on her from behind, and she'd do a vertical face plant. "Whatever works," she'd say. "And baby, this works." Now she was doing the upside-down splits move with the one-handed mid-stroke. She didn't convince me, but the men down there were never much interested in art. They'd think Savona was great unless she laughed instead of moaning, or actually fell off the trapeze. I left the snake pit and flipped through the other rooms, but nothing much was going on. No fetishists, nobody who wanted to be covered in feathers or slathered in porridge or strung up with velvet ropes or writhed on by guppies. Just the daily grind. Then I called Amanda. We're each other's family. I guess when we were kids, we were both stray puppies. It's a bond. Amanda was in the Wisconsin desert, putting together one of the bio-art installations she's been doing now that she's into what she calls the art caper. It was cow bones this time. Wisconsin's covered with cow bones, ever since the big drought 10 years ago, when they'd found it cheaper to butcher the cows there rather than shipping them out, the ones that hadn't died on their own. She had a couple of fuel cell front-end loaders and two illegal Tex-Mexican refugees she'd hired, and she was dragging the cow bones into a pattern so big it could only be seen from above. Huge capital letters spelling out a word. Later, she'd cover it in pancake syrup and wait until the insect life was all over it, and then take videos of it from the air to put into galleries. She liked to watch things move and grow and then disappear. Amanda always got the money to do her art capers. She was kind of famous in the circles that went in for culture. They weren't big circles, but they were rich circles. This time she had a deal with the top Corpsey Corps guy. He'd get her up in the helicopter to take the videos. "I traded Mr. Big for a whirly," was how she told me. We never said Corpsey Corps or helicopter on the phone, because they had robots listening in for special words like those. Her Wisconsin thing was part of a series called The Living Word. She said for a joke that it was inspired by the gardeners because they'd repressed us so much about writing things down. She'd begun with one-letter words, I and A and O, and then done two-letter words like it, and then three letters and four and five. Now she was up to six. They'd been written in all different materials, including fish guts and toxic spill-killed birds and toilets from building demolition sites filled with used cooking oil and set on fire. Her new word was kaput. When she told me that earlier, she'd said she was sending a message. "Who to?" I'd said. "The people who go to the galleries? The Mr. Rich and Biggs?" "That's who," she'd said. "And the Mrs. Rich and Biggs. Them, too." "You'll get in trouble, Amanda." "It's okay," she said. "They won't understand it." The project was going fine, she said. It had rained. The desert flowers were in bloom. There were a lot of insects, which was good for when she'd pour on the syrup. She already had the K done, and she was halfway through the A, but the Tex-Mexicans were getting bored. "That makes two of us," I said. "I can hardly wait to get out of here." "Three," said Amanda. "There's two of them, the Tex-Mexicans, plus you. Three." "Oh, right. You're looking great. That khaki outfit suits you." She was tall. She had that rangy girl explorer look, a pith helmet look. "You're not bad yourself," said Amanda. "Ren, you take care." "You take care, too. Don't let the Tex-Mex guys jump you."
"They won't. They think I'm crazy. Crazy women cut your dong off."
"I didn't know that," I was laughing. Amanda liked to make me laugh.
"Why would you?" said Amanda. "You're not crazy. You've never seen one of those things wriggling on the floor."
"Sweet dreams." "Sweet dreams, too," I said. But she'd clicked off. I've lost track of the saints' days. I can't remember which one it is today, but I can count the years. I've used my eyebrow pencil on the wall to add up how long I've known Amanda. I've done it like those old cartoons of prisoners, four strokes and then one through them to make five. It's been a long time, over 15 years, ever since she came into the gardeners. So many people from my earlier life were from there. Amanda and Bernice and Zeb and Adam One and Shacky and Croge and old Pilar. And Toby, of course.
I wonder what they'd think of me, of what I ended up doing for a living. Some of them would be disappointed, like Adam One. Bernice would say I was backsliding, and it served me right. Lucerne would say I'm a slut, and I'd say, takes one to know one. Pilar would look at me wisely. Shacky and Croge would laugh. Toby would be mad at Scales. What about Zeb? I think he'd try to rescue me because it would be a challenge. Amanda knows already. She doesn't judge. She says, you trade what you have to. You don't always have choices. Chapter 12. When Lucerne and Zeb first took me away from the external world to live among the gardeners, I didn't like it at all. They smiled a lot, but they scared me. They were so interested in doom and enemies and God, and they talked so much about death. The gardeners were strict about not killing life, but on the other hand, they said death was a natural process, which was sort of a contradiction now that I think about it. They had the idea that turning into compost would be just fine. Not everyone might think that having your body become part of a vulture was a terrific future to look forward to, but the gardeners did. And when they'd start talking about the waterless flood that was going to kill everybody on Earth, except maybe them, that gave me nightmares. None of it scared the real gardener kids. They were used to it. They'd even make fun of it, or the older boys would. Shacky and Croge and their pals. We're all gonna die, they'd say, making dead person faces. Hey, Wren, wanna do your bit for the cycle of life? Lie down in that dumpster, you can be the compost. Hey, Wren, wanna be a maggot? Lick my cut. Shut up, Bernice would say, or you're going into that dumpster yourself because I'm shoving you in. Bernice was mean, and she stood her ground, and most kids would back off. Even the boys would. But then I'd owe Bernice, and I'd have to do what she said. Shacky and Croge would tease me, though, when Bernice wasn't around to push back at them. They were slug squeezers. They were beetle eaters. They tried to gross you out. They were trouble. That's what Toby called them. I'd hear her saying to Rebecca, "Here comes trouble." Shacky was the oldest. He was tall and skinny, and he had a spider tattoo on the inside of his arm that he'd punched in himself with a needle and some candle soot. Croge was a stumpier shape, with a round head and a missing side tooth, which he claimed had been knocked out in a street battle. They had a little brother whose name was Oates. They didn't have any parents. They'd had some once, but their father had gone off with Zeb on some special Adam trip and had never come back, and then their mother had left, telling Adam One she'd send for them when she'd got herself established. But she never had. The gardener's school was in a different building from the rooftop. It was called the Wellness Clinic, because that's what used to be in there. It still had some leftover boxes full of gauze bandages, which the gardeners were gleaning for crafts projects. It smelled of vinegar. Across the hallway from the schoolrooms was the room the gardeners used for their vinegar making. The benches at the wellness clinic were hard. We sat in rows. We wrote on slates, and they had to be wiped off at the end of each day because the gardeners said you couldn't leave words lying around where our enemies might find them. Anyway, paper was sinful because it was made from the flesh of trees. We spent a lot of time memorizing things and chanting them out loud. The gardener history, for instance, it went like this. Year one, garden just begun. Year two, still new. Year three, Pilar started bees. Year four, Bert came in the door. Year five, Toby snatched alive. Year six, Katuro in the mix. Year seven, Zeb came to our heaven. Year seven should have said that I came too, and my mother, Lucerne, and anyway it wasn't heaven, but the gardeners liked their chance to rhyme. Year eight, Nuala found her fate. Year nine, Philo began to shine. I wanted Year 10 to have Wren in it, but I didn't think it would. The other things we had to memorize were harder. Mathematical and science things were the worst. We also had to memorize every saint's day, and every single day had at least one saint and sometimes more, or maybe a feast, which meant over 400 of those, plus what the saints had done to get to be saints. Some of them were easy. Saint Yossi Leshem of Barn Owls. Well, it was obvious what the answer was. And Saint Diane Fossey, because the story was so sad. And Saint Shackleton, because it was heroic. But some of them were really hard. Who could remember Saint Bashir al-Wasi, or Saint Crick, or Podocarp Day? I always got Podocarp Day wrong, because what was a podocarp? It was an ancient kind of tree, but it sounded like a fish. Our teachers were Nuala for the little kids and the Buds and Blooms choir and fabric recycling, and Rebecca for culinary arts, which meant cooking, and Surya for sewing, and Mugi for mental arithmetic, and Pilar for bees and mycology, and Toby for holistic healing with plant remedies, and Bert for wild and garden botanicals, and Philo for meditation, and Zeb for predator-prey relationships and animal camouflage. There were some other teachers. When we were 13, we'd get Katuro for emergency medical, and Marushka midwife for the human reproductive system, whereas all we'd had so far was frog ovaries, but those were the main ones. The Gardner kids had nicknames for all of the teachers. Pilar was the fungus. Zeb was the Mad Adam. Stuart was the screw because he built the furniture. Mugi was the muscle. Marushka was the mucus. Rebecca was the salt and pepper. Bert was the knob because he was bald. Toby was the dry witch. Witch because she was always mixing things up and pouring them into bottles. And dry because she was so thin and hard. And to tell her apart from Nuala, who was the wet witch, because of her damp mouth and her wobbly bum, and because you could make her cry so easily. In addition to the learning chants, the Gardner kids had rude ones they made up themselves. They'd chant softly. Shackleton and Crozier and the older boys would start, but then we'd all join in. Wet witch, big fat slobbery bitch, sell her to the butcher, make yourself rich, eat her in a sausage, wet witch. It was especially bad about the butcher and the sausage, because meat of any kind was obscene as far as the gardeners were concerned. Stop that, Nuala would say, but then she'd sniffle, and the older boys would give each other a thumbs up. We could never make Dry Witch Toby cry. The boys said she was a hard ass. She and Rebecca were the two hardest asses. Rebecca was jolly on the outside, but you did not push her buttons. As for Toby, she was leathery, inside and out. Don't try it, Shackleton, she would say, even though her back was turned. Nuala was too kind to us, but Toby held us to account, and we trusted Toby more. You'd trust a rock more than a cake. Chapter 13. I lived with Lucerne and Zeb in a building about 5 blocks from the garden. It was called the Cheese Factory, because that's what it used to be, and it still had a faint, cheesy smell to it. After the cheese, it was used for artist lofts, but there weren't any artists left, and nobody seemed to know who owned it. Meanwhile, the gardeners had taken it over. They liked living in places where they didn't have to pay rent. Our space was a big room, with some cubicles curtained off, one for me, one for Lucerne and Zeb, one for the violet, one for the shower. The cubicle curtains were woven of plastic bag strips and duct tape, and they weren't in any way soundproof. This wasn't great, especially when it came to the violet. The gardeners said digestion was holy, and there was nothing funny or terrible about the smells and noises that were part of the end product of the nutritional process. But at our place, those end products were hard to ignore. We ate our meals in the main room, on a table made out of a door. all of our dishes and pots and pans were salvaged. Gleaned, as the gardener said, except for some of the thicker plates and mugs. Those had been made by the gardeners back in their ceramics period, before they'd decided that kilns used up too much energy. I slept on a futon stuffed with husks and straw. It had a quilt sewed out of blue jeans and used bath mats, and every morning I had to make the bed first thing, because the gardeners liked neatly made beds, though they weren't squeamish about what they were made of. Then I'd take my clothes down from the nail on the wall and put them on. I got clean ones every seventh day. The gardeners didn't believe in wasting water and soap on too much washing. My clothes were always dank because of the humidity and because the gardeners didn't believe in dryers. God made the sun for a reason, Nuala used to say, and according to her, that reason was for drying our clothes. Lucerne would still be in bed, it being her favorite place. Back when we'd lived at Healthweiser with my real father, she'd hardly ever stayed inside our house. But here, she almost never went out of it, except to go over to the rooftop or the wellness clinic and help the other gardener women peel burdock roots or make those lumpy quilts or weave those plastic bag curtains or something. Zeb would be in the shower. No daily showers was one of the many gardener rules Zeb ignored. Our shower water came down a garden hose, out of a rain barrel, and was gravity-fed, so no energy was used. That was Zeb's reason for making an exception for himself. He'd be singing, "Nobody gives a hoot, nobody gives a hoot, and that is why we're down the chute, 'cause nobody gives a hoot." All his shower songs were negative in this way, though he sang them cheerfully in his big Russian bear voice. I had mixed feelings about Zeb. He could be frightening, but also it was reassuring to have someone so important in my family. Zeb was an Adam, a leading Adam. You could tell by the way the others looked up to him. He was large and solid, with a biker's beard and long hair, brown with a little gray in it, and a leathery face and eyebrows like a barbed wire fence. He looked as if he ought to have a silver tooth and a tattoo, but he didn't. He was strong as a bouncer, and he had the same menacing but genial expression, as if he'd break your neck if necessary, but not for fun. Sometimes he'd play dominoes with me. The gardeners were skimpy on toys. Nature is our playground. And the only toys they approved of were sewed out of leftover fabric, or knitted with saved-up string, or they'd be wrinkly old-person figures with heads fashioned from dried crab apples. But they allowed dominoes because they carved the sets themselves. When I won, Zeb would laugh and say, "Atta girl," and then I'd get a warm feeling, like nasturtiums. Lucerne was always telling me to be nice to him, because although he wasn't my real father, he was like my real father, and it hurt his feelings if I was rude to him. But then she didn't like it much when Zeb was nice to me, so it was hard to know how to act. While Zeb was singing in the shower, I'd get myself something to eat, dry soy bits, or maybe a vegetable patty left over from dinner. Lucerne was a fairly terrible cook. Then I'd go off to school. I was usually still hungry, but I could count on a school lunch. It wouldn't be great, but it would be food. As Adam One used to say, hunger is the best sauce. I couldn't remember ever being hungry at the Healthweiser compound. I really wanted to go back there. I wanted my real father, who must still love me. If he'd known where I was, he'd surely have come to take me back. I wanted my real house, with my own room, and the bed with pink bed curtains, and the closet full of different clothes in it. But most of all, I wanted my mother to be the way she used to be, when she'd take me shopping, or go to the club to play golf, or off to the Anu-U spa to get improvements done to herself, and then she'd come back smelling nice. But if I mentioned anything about our old life, she'd say all that was in the past. She had a lot of reasons for running off with Zeb to join the gardeners. She'd say their way was best for humankind, and for all the other creatures on Earth as well. And she'd acted out of love, not only for Zeb, but for me, because she wanted the world to be healed so life wouldn't die out completely, and didn't it make me happy to know that? She herself didn't seem all that happy. She'd sit at the table brushing her hair, staring at herself in our one small mirror, with an expression that was glum, or critical, or maybe tragic. She had long hair, like all the gardener women, and the brushing and the braiding and the pinning up was a big job. On bad days, she'd go through the whole thing 4 or 5 times. On the days when Zeb was away, she'd barely talk to me, or she'd act as if I'd hidden him.
"When did you last see him?" she'd say. "Was he at school?"
It was like she wanted me to spy on him. Then she'd be apologetic and say, "How are you feeling?" as if she'd done something wrong to me. When I'd answer, she wouldn't be listening. Instead, she'd be listening for Zeb. She'd get more and more anxious, even angry. She'd pace around and look out our window, talking to herself about how badly he treated her. But when he'd finally turn up, she'd fall all over him. Then she'd start nagging. Where had he been? Who had he been with? Why hadn't he come back sooner? He'd just shrug and say, "It's okay, babe. I'm here now. You worry too much." Then the two of them would disappear behind their plastic strip and duct tape curtain, and my mother would make pained and abject noises I found mortifying. I hated her then, because she had no pride and no restraint. It was like she was running down the middle of the mallway with no clothes on. Why did she worship Zeb so much? Now I can see how that can happen. You can fall in love with anybody, a fool, a criminal, a nothing. There are no good rules. The other thing I disliked so much at the gardeners was the clothes. The gardeners themselves were all colors, but their clothes weren't. If nature was beautiful, as the Adams and the Eves claimed, if the lilies of the field were our models, why couldn't we look more like butterflies and less like parking lots? We were so flat, so plain, so scrubbed, so dark. The street kids, the plebe rats, were hardly rich, but they were glittery. I envied the shiny things, the shimmering things, like the TV camera phones, pink and purple and silver, that flashed in and out of their hands like magicians' cards, or the See Here candies they stuck into their ears to hear music. I wanted their gaudy freedom. We were forbidden to make friends with the plebe rats, and on their part, they treated us like pariahs, holding their noses and yelling or throwing things at us. The Adams and the Eves said we were being persecuted for our faith, but it was most likely for our wardrobes. The plebe rats were very fashion-conscious and wore the best clothes they could trade or steal. So we couldn't mingle with them, but we could eavesdrop. We got their knowledge that way. We caught it like germs. We gazed at that forbidden worldly life as if through a chain-link fence. Once I found a beautiful camera phone lying on the sidewalk. It was muddy and the signal was dead, but I took it home anyway, and the Eves caught me with it. "Don't you know any better?" they said. "Such a thing can hurt you. It can burn your brain. Don't even look at it. If you can see it, it can see you." Chapter 14. I first met Amanda in year 10, when I was 10. I was always the same age as the year, so it's easy to remember when it was. That day was St. Farley of Wolves, a young bioneer scavenging day, when we had to tie sucky green bandanas around our necks and go out gleaning for the gardener's recycled materials crafts. Sometimes we collected soap ends, carrying wicker baskets and making the rounds of the good hotels and restaurants because they threw out soap by the shovelful. The best hotels were in the rich plebes, Fernside, Golf Greens, and the richest of all, Solar Space. And we'd hitch rides to them, even though it was forbidden. The gardeners were like that. They'd tell you to do something, and then prohibit the easiest way to do it. Rose-scented soap was the best. Bernice and me would take some home, and I'd keep mine in my pillowcase to drown out the mildew smell of my damp quilt. We'd take the rest to the gardeners, to be simmered into a jelly in the black box solar cookers on the rooftop, then cooled and cut up into slabs. The gardeners used a lot of soap because they were so worried about microbes. But some of the cut-up soaps would be set aside. They'd be rolled up in leaves and have strands of twisted grass tied around them to be sold to tourists and gawkers at the gardener's Tree of Life Natural Materials Exchange, along with the bags of worms and the organic turnips and zucchinis and the other vegetables the gardeners hadn't used up themselves. That day wasn't a soap day. It was a vinegar day. We'd go to the back entrances of the bars and nightclubs and strip joints and pick through their dump boxes and find any leftover wine and pour it into our young Bioneer enamel pails. Then we'd lug it off to the wellness clinic building, where it would be poured into the huge barrels in the vinegar room and fermented into vinegar, which the gardeners used for household cleaning. The extra was decanted into the small bottles we'd gather up during our gleaning, which would have gardeners' labels glued onto them. Then they'd be offered for sale at the Tree of Life, along with the soap. Our young Bioneer work was supposed to teach us some useful lessons. For instance, nothing should be carelessly thrown away, not even wine from sinful places. There was no such thing as garbage, trash, or dirt, only matter that hadn't been put to a proper use. And most importantly, everyone, including children, had to contribute to the life of the community. Shacky and Croge and the older boys sometimes drank their wine instead of saving it. If they drank too much, they'd fall down or throw up, or they'd get into fights with the plebe rats and throw stones at the winos. In revenge, the winos would pee into empty wine bottles to see if they could trick us. I never drank any piss myself. All you had to do was smell the opening of the bottle. But some kids had deadened their noses by smoking the butt ends of cigarettes or cigars or even skunkweed if they could get it, and they'd upend the bottle, then spit and swear. Though maybe those kids drank from the peed-in bottles on purpose to give themselves an excuse for the swearing, which was forbidden by the gardeners. As soon as they were out of sight of the garden, Shacky and Croge and those boys would take off their young Bioneer bandanas and tie them around their heads, like the Asian fusions. They wanted to be a street gang, too. They even had a password. "Gang," they'd say, and the other person was supposed to say, "Green." So, gang green. The gang part was because they were a gang, and the green stood for green, like their headscarves. It was supposed to be a secret thing just for their gang members, but we all knew about it anyway. Bernice said it was a really good password for them because gangrene was flesh rot, and they were totally rotten.
"Big joke, Bernice," said Crozier. "P.S. you're ugly."
We were supposed to glean in groups so we could defend ourselves against the plebe rats, street gangs, or the winos who might grab our pails and drink the wine, or the child snatchers who might sell us on the chicken sex market. But instead, we'd break up in twos or threes, because that way we could cover the territory faster. On this particular day, I started out with Bernice, but then we had a fight. We squabbled constantly, which I took as a sign of our friendship, because no matter how viciously we fought, we'd always make up afterwards. Some bond held us together, not hard like bone, but slippery like cartilage. Most likely we both felt insecure among the gardener kids. We were each afraid to be left without an ally. This time our fight was over a beaded change purse with a starfish on it that we'd picked out of a trash pile. We coveted finds like that, and were always looking for them. The Pleblanders threw a lot of stuff away because, said the Adams and Eves, they had short attention spans and no morals.
"I saw it first," I said.
"You saw it first last time," said Bernice.
"So what? I still saw it first."
"Your mother's a skank," said Bernice.
That was unfair, because I thought so myself and Bernice knew it.
Yours is a vegetable, I said.
Vegetable shouldn't have been an insult among the gardeners, but it was.
Vina the vegetable, I added.
Meat breath, said Bernice. She had the purse, and she was keeping it.
Fine,
I said. I turned and walked away. I loitered, but I didn't look around, and Bernice didn't hurry after me. This happened at the mallway, which was called Apple Corners. This was the official name of our plebe, though everyone called it the sinkhole, because people vanished into it without a trace. We gardener kids walked through the mallway whenever we could, just looking. Like everything else in our plebe, this mallway had once been classier. There was a broken fountain full of empty beer cans. There were built-in planters with a lot of zizzy fruit cans and cigarette butts and used condoms covered, said Nuala, in festering germs. There was a hollow spinner booth that must once have spun out suns and moons and rare animals and your own image if you put money in, but it had been trashed some time ago and now stood empty-eyed. Sometimes we went inside it and pulled the tattered star-sprinkled curtain across and read the messages left on the walls by the plebe rats. Monica sucks. So does Darf, only better. Your dollars? For you, free. Baby Kates. Brad, you are dead. Those plebe rats were so daring, they'd write anywhere or anything. They didn't care who saw it. The sinkhole plebe rats went into the hollow spinner to smoke dope. The booth reeked of it. And they had sex in there. We could tell because of the condoms and sometimes the panties they'd leave behind. Gardener kids weren't supposed to do either one of those things. Hallucinogenics were for religious purposes, and sex was for those who'd exchanged green leaves and jumped the bonfire. But the older gardener kids said they'd done them anyway. The shops that weren't boarded up were $20 stores called Tinsels and Wildside and Bongs, names like that. They sold feather hats and crayons for drawing on your body and T-shirts with dragons and skulls and mean slogans. Also, Jolt bars and chewing gum that made your tongue glow in the dark, and red-lipped ashtrays that said, "Let me blow it for you." And in your skin etch-a-tattoos, the Eve said would burn your skin down to the veins. You could find expensive stuff at bargain prices that Shacky said were boosted from the solar space boutiques. "Tawdry rubbish, all of it," the Eves would say. "If you're going to sell your soul, at least demand a higher price." Bernice and I paid no attention to that. Our souls didn't interest us. We'd peer in the windows, giddy with wanting.
"What would you get?" we'd say. "The LED light wand? That's baby. The Blood and Roses video? Oh, gross, that's for boys. The real woman stick-on bimplants with responsive nipples? Ren, you suck."
After Bernice had left that day, I wasn't sure what to do. I thought maybe I should just go back because I didn't feel too safe alone. Then I saw Amanda, standing on the other side of the mallway with a group of Tex-Mexican plebe girls. I knew that group by sight, and Amanda had never been with them before. Those girls were wearing the sort of clothes they usually wore, mini skirts and spangled tops, candy floss boas around their necks, silver gloves, plasticized butterflies clipped into their hair. They had their See Here candies, and their burning bright phones, and their jellyfish bracelets, and they were showing off. They were playing the same tune on their See Here candies, and they were dancing to it, swiveling their bums, sticking out their chests. They looked as if they already owned everything from every single store and were bored with it. I envied that look so much. I just stood there, envying. Amanda was dancing too, except she was better. After a while, she stopped and stood a little apart, texting on her purple phone. Then she stared straight at me and smiled and waved her silver fingers. That meant, "Come here." I checked that no one was looking. Then I crossed the mallway.
Chapter 15.
You want to see my jellyfish bracelet? Amanda said once I got there. I must have seemed pathetic to her, with my orphanish clothes and chalky fingers. She held up her wrist. There were the tiny jellyfish, opening and closing themselves, like swimming flowers. They looked so perfect.
Where did you get it?
I asked. I hardly knew what to say.
Lifted, said Amanda.
That was how the plebrat girls mostly got things.
How do they stay alive in there?
She pointed to the silver knob where the bracelet fastened. This is an aerator, she said. It pumps in oxygen. You add the food twice a week.
What happens if you forget?
They eat each other, said Amanda. She gave a little smile. Some kids do that on purpose. They don't add the food. Then it's like a mini war in there. And after a while, there's just one jellyfish left. And then it dies.
That's horrible, I said.
Amanda kept the same smile. Yeah, that's why they do it. They're really pretty, I said in a neutral voice. I wanted to please her, and I couldn't tell whether she thought horrible was good or bad.
Take it, said Amanda.
She held out her wrist. I can lift another one. I wanted that bracelet so badly, but I wouldn't know how to buy the food, and the jellyfish would die. Or else the bracelet would be discovered, no matter how well I hid it, and I'd be in trouble.
I can't, I said.
I took a step back.
You're one of them, aren't you? Said Amanda.
She wasn't taunting. She seemed merely curious. The gaudies, the god-awfuls, they say there's a bunch of them around here.
No, I said, I'm not.
The lie must have stood out all over me. There were a lot of shabby people in the sinkhole plebe, but they weren't shabby on purpose, the way the gardeners were. Amanda tilted her head a little to one side.
Funny, she said. You look like them.
I only live with them, I said. I'm just more or less visiting them. I'm not really like them at all.
Of course you aren't, said Amanda, smiling.
She gave my arm a little pat.
Come over here. I want to show you something.
Where she took me was the alleyway that led to the back of Scales and Tails. We gardener kids weren't supposed to go there, but we did anyway, because when we were collecting, you could get a lot of vinegar wine if you were early enough to beat out the winos. That alleyway was dangerous. Scales and Tails was a dirt den, said the Eves. We should never, ever go into it, especially not girls. It said, Adult Entertainment, in neon over the door, which was guarded at night by two enormous men in black suits who wore sunglasses even though it was dark. One of the older gardener girls claimed these men had said to her, Come back in a year and bring your sweet little ass. But Bernice said she was just bragging. Scales had pictures on either side of the entrance. Light-up hollow photos. The pictures were of beautiful girls covered completely with shining green scales, like lizards, except for the hair. One of them was standing on a single leg, with the other leg hooked around her neck. I thought that it must hurt to stand like that, but the girl in the picture was smiling. Did the scales grow, or were they pasted on? Bernice and I disagreed about that. I said they were pasted. Bernice said they grew, because the girls had been operated on, like getting bimplants. I told Bernice that was nuts because nobody would have such an operation. But secretly, I sort of believed her. One day we'd seen a scaly girl running down the street in daytime, with a black-suited man chasing her. She sparkled a lot because of her shiny green scales. She'd kicked off her high heels, and she was running in her bare feet, dodging in and out among the people. But then she hit a patch of broken glass and fell. The man caught up with her and scooped her up and carried her back to Scales with her green snakeskin arms dangling down. Her feet were bleeding. Whenever I thought of that, a chill went all through me, like watching someone else cut their finger. At the back of the alleyway beside Scales, there was a small square yard where the trash bins were kept.
the ones for the carbon garboil trash and the other kind. Then there was a board fence, and on the other side of it there was a vacant lot where a building had burned down. Now it was just hard earth with pieces of cement and charred wood and broken glass and weeds growing on it. Sometimes the plebe rats hung out around there, and they'd jump us when we were emptying the wine bottles. They'd yell, "Gaudy, gaudy, stinky body," and snatch the pails and run off with them, or empty them onto us. That happened to Bernice once, and she reeked of wine for days. Sometimes we went into that vacant lot with Zeb on our outdoor classroom days. He said it was the closest thing to a meadow we'd ever find in our plebe. When he was with us, the plebeland kids didn't bother us. Zeb was like having your own private tiger, tame to you, savage to everyone else. Once we found a dead girl there. She didn't have any hair or clothes. She only had a few green scales left clinging to her. Pasted on, I thought, or something. Anyway, not growing. So I was right. "Maybe she's sunbathing," said one of the older boys, and the rest of them snickered. "Don't touch her," said Zeb. "Have some respect. We'll have our lesson on the rooftop garden today." When we came back for our next outdoor classroom, she was gone. "I bet she's carbon garboil," Bernice whispered to me. Carbon garboil was made from any sort of carbon garbage, slaughterhouse refuse, old vegetables, restaurant toss-out, even plastic bottles. The carbs went into a boiler, and oil and water came out, plus anything metal. Officially, you couldn't put in human corpses, but the kids made jokes about that. Oil, water, and shirt buttons. Oil, water, and gold pen nibs. "Oil, water, and green scales," I whispered to Bernice. At first glance, the vacant lot was empty. No winos, no plebe rats, no dead naked women. Amanda led me over to the far corner, where there was a flat slab of concrete. A syrup bottle was leaning against it, the squeeze kind. "Look at this," she said. She'd written her name in syrup on the slab, and a stream of ants was feeding on the letters, so that each letter had an edging of black ants. That was how I first learned Amanda's name. I saw it written in ants. Amanda Payne. "Cool, huh?" she said. "Want to write your own name?" "Why are you doing that?" I said. "It's neat," said Amanda. "You write things, then they eat your writing. So you appear, then you disappear. That way, no one can find you." Why did this make sense to me? I don't know, but it did. "Where do you live?" I asked. "Oh, around," said Amanda carelessly. That meant she didn't really live anywhere. She was sleeping in a squat somewhere, or worse. "I used to live in Texas," she added. So she was a refugee. A lot of Texas refugees had turned up after the hurricanes and then the droughts. They were mostly illegal. Now I could see why Amanda would be so interested in disappearing. "You can come and live with me," I said. I hadn't planned that. It just came out of my mouth. At that moment, Bernice squeezed through the gap in the fence. She'd relented. She'd returned to collect me. Except now, I didn't want her. "Wren, what are you doing?" she yelled. She came clomping across the vacant lot in that purposeful way she had. I found myself thinking she had big feet, and her body was too square, and her nose too small, and her neck ought to be longer and thinner, more like Amanda's. "Here comes a friend of yours, I guess," said Amanda, smiling. I felt like saying, "She's not my friend," but I wasn't brave enough to be that treacherous. Bernice came up to us, red-faced. She always got red when she was mad. "Come on, Wren," she said. "You're not supposed to talk to her." She spotted Amanda's jellyfish bracelet, and I could tell she wanted it as much as I did. "You're evil," she said to Amanda. "Plebe rat,"
She stuck her arm through mine. "This is Amanda," I said. "She's coming to live with me." I thought Bernice would fly into one of her rages, but I was giving her my stony-eyed stare, the one that said I wasn't going to give in. She'd risk losing face in front of a stranger if she pushed too hard, so instead, she gave me a silent, calculating look.
"Okay, then," she said. "She can help carry the vinegar wine."
"Amanda knows how to steal things," I said to Bernice as we trudged back to the wellness clinic. I meant this as a peace offering, but Bernice only grunted. Chapter 16. I knew I couldn't really take Amanda home with me like a stray kitten. Lucerne would have told me to put her back where I found her, because Amanda was a plebe rat, and Lucerne hated plebe rats. According to her, they were ruined children, thieves and liars all, and once a child had been ruined, it was like a wild dog. It could never be trained or trusted. She was afraid to walk along the street from one gardener place to another because of the plebe rat gangs that could swarm you and run off with anything they could grab. She never learned about picking up stones and hitting back and yelling. It was because of her earlier life. She was a hothouse flower. That's what Zeb called her. I used to think this was a compliment because of the word flower. So Amanda would be sent packing unless I got Adam One's permission first. He loved people joining the gardeners, especially kids. He was always going on about how the gardeners should mold young minds. If he said Amanda should live with us, Lucerne wouldn't be able to say no. The three of us found Adam One at the wellness clinic, helping to bottle the vinegar. I explained that I'd picked up Amanda, gleaned her, I said, and that she wished to join us, having seen the light, and could she live at my house? "Is that true, my child?" Adam One asked Amanda. The other gardeners had stopped work and were eyeing Amanda's miniskirt and silver fingers. "Yes, sir," said Amanda in a respectful voice. "She'll be a bad influence on Ren," said Nuala, who had come over. "Ren is too easily led. We should place her with Bernice." Bernice gave me a triumphant look. "See what you've done."
"That would be fine," she said neutrally.
"No," I said. "I found her." Bernice glared at me. Amanda said nothing. Adam One considered the three of us. He knew a lot of things.
"Perhaps Amanda herself should decide," he said. "She should meet the families in question. That will help to settle the matter. That would be fairest, no?"
"My place first," said Bernice.
Bernice lived in the Buena Vista condos. The gardeners didn't exactly own the building because ownership was wrong, but somehow they controlled it. It had luxury lofts for today's singles on it in faded gold lettering, but I knew it wasn't luxury. The shower in Bernice's apartment was clogged. The tiles in the kitchen were cracked and gap-toothed. The ceilings oozed when it rained. The bathroom was slick with mildew. The three of us went into the lobby, past the middle-aged gardener lady on security duty there. She was busy with some snarled-up macrame craft object and hardly noticed us. We had to climb 6 flights of stairs to get to Bernice's floor, because the gardeners didn't believe in elevators, except for old people and paraplegics. There were forbidden objects in the stairwell. Needles, used condoms, spoons, candle ends. The gardeners said plebe crooks and thugs and pimps got in at night and used the stairwell for nasty parties. We'd never seen any of these, though we'd once caught Shacky and Croge and their pals drinking wine dregs in there. Bernice had her own plasticky. She unlocked the door and let us in. The apartment smelled like unwashed clothes left under a dripping sink, or like other kids' plugged sinuses, or like diapers. Through these odors drifted another one, a rich, fertile, spicy, earthy aroma. Maybe it was wafting up through the hot air vents from the gardener mushroom beds in the basement. But this smell, all the smells, seemed to be coming from Bernice's mother, Vina, who was sitting on the worn plush-covered sofa, as if rooted there,
staring at the wall. She had on her usual shapeless dress. Her knees were covered with an old yellow baby blanket. Her pale hair hung limply on either side of her round, soft, whitish face. Her hands lay curled slackly, as if her fingers were broken. On the floor in front of her was a scattering of dirty plates. Vina didn't cook. She ate what Bernice's father gave her, or else she didn't eat it. But she never tidied up. She hardly ever spoke, and she didn't speak now. Her eyes flickered as we went past her, though. So maybe she saw us.
"What's the matter with her?" Amanda whispered to me. "She's fallow," I whispered back.
"Yeah?" Amanda whispered.
"She just looks really stoned."
My own mother said Bernice's mother was depressed. But my mother wasn't a real gardener, as Bernice was always telling me, because a real gardener would never say depressed. The gardeners believed that people who acted like Vina were in a fallow state, resting, retreating into themselves to gain spiritual insight, gathering their energy for the moment when they would burst out again like buds in spring. They only appeared to be doing nothing. Some gardeners could remain in a fallow state for a very long time.
"This is my place," said Bernice.
"Where would I sleep?" said Amanda. We were looking at Bernice's room when Bert the Knob came in.
"Where's my little girl?" he called.
"Don't answer," said Bernice. "Close the door."
We could hear him moving around in the main room. Then he came into Bernice's room and scooped her up. He stood there holding her under the armpits.
"Where's my little girl?" he said again, which made me cringe. I'd seen him do this before, not only to Bernice. He just loved girls' armpits. He'd corner you in behind the bean rows when you were doing slug and snail relocation and pretend to be helping you. Then along would come the hands. He was such a knob.
Bernice was scowling and wriggling.
"I'm not your little girl,"
she said, which could mean "I'm not little," or "I'm not yours," or even "I'm not a girl." Bert took this as a joke.
"Then where's my little girl gone?" he repeated in a woebegone voice.
"Put me down," Bernice shouted. I felt sorry for her, and also I felt lucky, because whatever I felt about Zeb, it wasn't embarrassment.
"I'd like to look at your place now," said Amanda. So the two of us went back down the stairs, leaving Bernice behind us, redder and angrier than ever. I did feel bad about that, but not bad enough to give up Amanda.